You know, I think I changed my mind. I like my music opening bed. What do you think? Let's hear it, Jesse. Crank up that music bed. Yeah, you know, it's got a cool little riff to it. Yeah, you're sitting back playing the air guitar a little bit, huh? All right. Let me know if you want me to change it. Mark and Mark Fadel, motivation.com. And the show's Insight Thursday, yes, Friday Eve right here in New York City, broadcasting live from downtown New York City. And today's show is a special show because I'm doing it live from my hoverboard. I hope I don't pull a Mike Tyson. Man, you know those things are dangerous. If Iron Mike was laid up in bed for a week from his hoverboard accident, wow. I think I'm going to pass on that. I mean, if you're going to get injured, you better do it in a cool way. Cooler way than a hoverboard. So, and not only that, but you're going to be banned in most states soon anyway. Got a great show coming your way. We're going to be talking to the Police Athletic League president of New York City, which is much more gargantuan than I ever thought of, providing recreation, educational, cultural, and social activities to over 35,000 boys and girls annually. It's also the city's largest independent nonprofit youth organization. Bet you didn't know that, huh? We're 1 minute into the show, and I'm just dazzling you with all this incredible information. Always love to hear your input. 888-874-4888. If you're in the tri-state area, anywhere in the States, anywhere in the world, anywhere you're hanging out listening to Insight on PRN.FM, love to hear from you, Mark, at markfarrellmotivation.com as well. So with the consideration of the Police Athletic League this morning, I was thinking about some things that I did as a kid that maybe would have impacted my future a little bit more in a positive manner. That, you know, obviously inner city kids have this great outlet, and we're going to be talking to our guests in a few moments. But I was thinking about, again, being a child, divorced parents at a young age, not really didn't have a mentor. My brother, my only brother, who was 15 years older than me, was out of the house. So kind of like I barely knew him. So I'd say I got into a fair amount of harmless trouble. I like to couch it as harmless trouble. Does that make sense? I mean, I broke into my neighbor's. This sounds bad. I said harmless trouble and I said I broke into my neighbor's. He has a big shop. He was a roofer. He has a really big shop. So big, I don't even think he knew like 2/3 of the stuff that was in there. And for some reason, I broke in there with my two female neighbors. I was probably 14, 15 at the time. And they had an old car in there, and I found some old paint. So I figured the old paint should go on top of the old car. Ridiculous idea. And I did it. And I got, well, I didn't get caught right there at the time, but I think my two cute neighbors squealed on me. I fessed up to it. And I certainly said that I would, you know, clean up the paint. So my lesson was learned that, you know, obviously telling the truth, first of all, not doing something so incredibly stupid. And then I spent, I don't know, a week or so with the neighbor's son, whose car it was, and, you know, got all the paint off, et cetera, and actually formed a good bond with the family and was very close to them and actually very close to one of them still because my cousin actually married her. But I was incredibly embarrassed, and still to this day, that I did something so ridiculous, you know, so immature. But, you know, I kind of know why I did it. I had a lot of time on my hands. My mother always working two jobs as a single parent and had a lot of free time. And not, you know, being visually impaired, I wasn't doing school sports. I certainly was in no means home studying, preparing for the next day. That's for sure. And so consequently, you know, I always had some cool things that I usually paid for myself or a majority of them, like a lot of bikes, motorcycles, got into them very early. So I had to kind of pay for those things. So I, you know, got a job early on. I think my first job, I don't count newspapers as my first job. You know, it does pay. But my first job was probably in sixth grade. I was cleaning up at a local mechanic shop, sweeping 2 or 3 days a week, only for like two hours a clip. And then I started working at a 7-Eleven. It was actually called Hubbard's Cupboard. I never saw another store called Hubbard's Cupboard, so I'm not sure if it was a chain back then. It was around a corner from me. So I just don't know how I got myself into this, but or why I would do such a thing. So I started stealing cartons of cigarettes back then. And I would put the cartons of cigarettes in the trash, take out the trash, and then sell them. Maybe you would say that's industrious, but I call it thievery. I never got caught. They loved me because I did an impeccable job. I mean, I guess my OCD for cleaning started back then at a very young age because, yeah, everywhere I worked, I was kind of a cleaning guy, you know. I stocked shelves, did all those things. But, I mean, it started back then at a very young age, stealing. So now, was I stealing because I was looking for attention, because I really wanted the money, because I was kind of lashing out because my parents were divorced? I mean, my parents were, you know, for the most part, it was very amicable. My father lived two or three blocks away, and he was my best buddy. You know, years before, you know, he was a different man when he was an alcoholic. But he totally changed his ways and was a great, loving father. So I'm not really sure, you know, why it happened. One time I actually got caught by the authorities. The authorities, he says. I was in a store called James Way. It's kind of like, I guess, a Walmart of those days. And a lot of bikes were being stolen in the neighborhood. Thievery was big in terms of, you know, if your bike wasn't locked up, it was gone. And, you know, when I was a kid, not everybody locked up their bike. So I go into the store, and I guess I was kind of dumbfounded at the price. I don't know, whatever it was, say maybe 10 bucks, whatever. So instead of stealing the bike lock that was going to keep my bike secure, I did the more honorable thing. I just reduced the price. Yeah, I did. I found a more affordable price tag, and I thought I was so slick. I'm not even looking at the package. I'm just kind of using my fingernail to kind of like easily peel up the cheaper label and sticker, and then nonchalantly, apply it and affix it to the other label that was on the bike lock that I needed to buy so my bike wouldn't get stolen, the bike that was actually in front of the store for what would be a long time, because the next part of the story was once I walked outside the door, they said, "Excuse me, son, we need to talk to you." And I was like, oh, no, my God, I was caught. I was busted. So, yes, I got caught. Security brought me back, and I was just I don't think I didn't cry, and I didn't wet my pants. I don't know how old I was. I'd say 13-ish. But what was pretty cool, which didn't take away from the lesson I learned, was they called my house. Of course, my mother always worked in two jobs. My sister answered the phone. And I guess they basically, long story short, because I don't know all the details in terms of what was actually said, my sister showed up at the store to kind of bail me out in a waitress uniform. So they automatically assumed she was my mother. And she was older, still is older, but, you know, not that much older, maybe 6 years older, still 6 years older, of course. That doesn't change. And they assumed, you know, Mrs. Farrell, you know, your son was caught, blah, blah, blah. So my sister, being as cool as she is and as astute as she is, just went with it. And, of course, you know, I still owe her to this day. We didn't tell my mother. She obviously didn't tell my mother we opted not to tell her for quite some time. And, you know, I learned my lesson, and I guess I went back and actually bought the lock and apologized to the store. You know, I did everything you could do at that age to kind of feel and or make amends. No, I guess maybe it was a form of entitlement, or was it just like I don't know. I mean, you know, it's funny. I can see other people, and I guess this is pretty common. See other people's issues a lot clearer than my own, especially when you're young. Like nowadays, it can definitely assess, you know, why you do certain things. But when I was little, smaller, you know, adolescent, young teens, wasn't sure why I did things, you know. You know, was I acting out? Was I because I wasn't accepted in school? You know, because I wasn't doing well academically. I couldn't do many sports. Didn't have a lot of friends. So I don't know. I guess that totally had an impact. But it made me think of that because, you know, our guest who's coming on in a few minutes, the executive director from the New York City chapter of the Police Athletic League, we're going to be talking about inner city youth. And though I wasn't an inner city youth child, it doesn't really matter because free time is free time. And, you know, there's trouble out there. You can find it or make your own. I really wasn't part excuse me, I wasn't part of, you know, other trouble in terms of, actually, you know, once or twice I was with some kids, come to think of it, and that were doing some nefarious things, and I was totally uncomfortable. And that one of the things they were doing, actually, I think I knew the people that they were, I forget what they're doing, trying to maybe damage someone's house. And I was like, listen, I'm out of here, and just split, because I'm like, hey, these are good people, can't do that, and left the scene. But never really hung out with a lot of kids anyway. But that was the case, and maybe that was – but that's how it starts, man. I can understand the gateway. Just like when I speak to schools, you know, K through 12 and colleges, that I tell them when I started smoking pot in age fifth grade. Yeah, fifth grade. Because I wanted to be accepted, be cool, be perceived as cool, even though I really didn't like it. Actually, the one thing I didn't do or take on a habit as is when I used to steal those cigarettes, I used to keep a pack for myself sometimes. I figured, well, hey, if I smoke a pack of Marlboro cigarettes, I mean, everyone's going to think I'm cool, right? You know, keep them in my sleeve. But after like 2 or 3 days of smoking a cigarette or two on a way to school without inhaling, I'm like, whoa, this is really gross. I can't even fake to be cool. So I just tossed them and never used them again. But, you know, it's interesting how easily, you know, the trajectory can be once you're in kind of a bad way or a bad path, you know. So we're going to meet our guests in a few minutes, but I want to tell you something about something totally unrelated. But in a parental way, is very, very cool. Yesterday, I was just speaking to one of my colleagues, Jason, who can relate because his son and or both of them have lost teeth. And so my son lost his tooth for the first time yesterday at age 6. And it's one tooth, man. It was hanging on for days. We're like, okay, it's going to come out for Christmas. Wrong. It's going to come out for New Year's. Let's pull it out at midnight, you know, 12:01. Wrong. So just last night, he went into the bathroom, wiggled it free. So he came out. We're all psyched, you know, did all the thing. And, you know, it was a great kind of a milestone being a parent, as you may or may not understand or will experience or have experienced, which is kind of a cool thing. So my wife spent, I kind of drifted off. It was kind of late at night. And then I got up and did a lot of work. And next thing I know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I come up to my dresser. My wife made this incredible letter to my son. With fairy dust, wink, wink, all over it, and with money on the fairy dust on the money and stuff. And it's just really, really cute and did a great job. And obviously kind of crystallized or supported what he should be doing in terms of brushing and flossing and how he should listen to his new favorite song on his new fire that he got for at least 3 minutes when he's brushing, yada, yada, yada. So it's kind of cool. But the funny part was, so I'm going into his bedroom. Now, for Christmas or Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate, you know, you can get away with putting presents clearly when the kids are asleep in a different room under a tree, whatever the case may be. But now I'm sneaking into a well-lit bedroom. He's out, but he's on his back. So he could open his eyes and be like, whoa, that is the tooth fairy. So I was actually pretty nervous. Here I am kind of creeping in, you know, looking very non-fairy-like. And I'm like, all right, I got to pull this baggie out from underneath his pillow and then slide this, you know, inconspicuously or without ruffling the pillow or anything. I'm like, if he opens his eyes, I am so busted. So I was really nervous because, you know, if it was in the dark, I could kind of like duck down or say, hey, you know, I was just coming to check on you or tuck you in. But if I have both his letter to the tooth fairy and then the tooth fairy's letter in my hand, I'm kind of like, I'm sure I would have gotten out of it somehow. But that's kind of how my early morning started. And actually, it even got better from there because I found a new app. I refresh your memory. I can drive a car with a pair of telescopic devices. They look like what a surgeon wears or what your dentist wears, where there's little telescopes on the outside of the glasses so I can see the color of a traffic light, a stoplight that I'm about to run, hopefully not run, things of that nature. So there are a lot of things that can make driving possible and legal for me. But one of the things that's very, very difficult, besides actually driving with those telescopic devices, is, believe it or not, and you're going to be like, holy crap, this guy's on the road, is seeing my speedometer. Yes, my speedometer. It's an analog, meaning it's just a dial. Some cars, my mom's car has a digital readout, which is probably 2.5-3 inches high. So it's a dream to drive that car. But I found out yesterday, I actually saw a commercial. The new iPhone, I think it's iPhone 6 something, came out. And the first scene in this commercial is somebody's got their iPhone 6 on their dashboard with a speedometer readout, which I don't know why they would include that in a commercial because you know, not how many people would actually use that, but it's made my day because I know when I'm going 60, 65, 70, 80, and 85, a little faster. But it's when you need to go 25, 35 in those areas where they're just waiting to slam you for a ticket. Those are the times it's really difficult to know exactly, you know, how fast I'm going because I'm unable to see the speedometer. So totally psyched about that. And it also made me think about how long will it be until these self-driving cars hit the road. You know, we know about this electronic show, all the technology that comes out there and the car shows, the compatibilities out there. And I'm really stoked about that. So, and how many years will it be where I won't even need to see, you know, I won't even need to use my telescopic devices because my car will be my complete and one and whole telescopic device. So for, think about this, for people with disabilities, much worse than mine, elderly people, I mean, this is great. You're not going to have to worry about that grandma who's 85 years old, you know, going 20 in a 40-mile-an-hour zone. But I was actually thinking about what would the insurance be? Now, how will insurance companies deal with this? Because there's money to be made, certainly, with people driving badly. Even if you don't drive badly, you still get in accidents because it's just what happens when objects move in different directions, different speeds, and people make mistakes. So that's my morning so far. Very, very good. And, of course, it always gets better here because when I get to speak to you and do my show every Thursday right here on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network, my name is Mark Farrell. When we come back, we're going to speak to the executive director of the Police Athletic League, an incredible organization, right after this.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Gary Null's incisive documentary and informational films on today's most crucial issues have won dozens of international awards. As a free service to listeners, acclaimed films such as War on Health and Seeds of Death are available to watch in their entirety online. Just go to YouTube and search for Gary Null. Thank you for your continued support.
This is journalist Dave Lindor. I'll be hosting the show This Can't Be Happening each Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. Because we know it is happening, each week's program will feature some issue that's been getting ignored or misreported, like Social Security, climate change, military spending, or the government's destruction of the Internet. Please join me at This Can't Be Happening on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern.
It's the BRONX. You know what's next.
It's a bowl of soul. And get your dose of classic soul and independent R&B music from the United States and abroad on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A Bowl of Soul is a music experience you won't forget or regret. Check out A Bowl of Soul on the Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Insight right here on PRN.FM. My name is Mark Farrell. Happy Thursday to you. A little warmer here in New York City. Actually getting very warm this weekend, which we're very excited to see the temperatures go up to the 50s. Yes, a lot of rain, but that's okay. A lot of great football on this weekend. Yeah, no New York City teams. That's okay. Well, actually, no, one New York City team. New York team. Anyway, I digress. My next guest is dedicated to addressing the needs of inner-city youth through promoting after-school programs, sports, and juvenile crime prevention, and much, much more. He's Frederick Watts, Executive Director of the Police Athletic League New York City. Hello and welcome to the show, Fred.
Thank you very much for having me.
Come on up to that microphone.
Sure.
Make friends with that microphone.
I'll do my best.
And point that up a little bit more.
Okay.
I know you're a well-spoken man. Well-educated, too.
Well, we tried.
Yeah. Brown. And where did you get your law degree?
Columbia.
Columbia. Not too far.
Not too far.
Well, you didn't come too far. because, well, I mean, you've come far in life. I'm not trying to insult you in the first 30 seconds of the interview. You've come very, very far. But you grew up in New York City. And
yes, I was born in the Bronx, grew up in Mount Vernon. So I'm sort of stayed pretty close to home.
So you are just cut for the cloth, from the cloth, for this job, because your father was a police detective, New York City police detective.
That's true.
Your mother was a teacher, special ed teacher.
Yes.
I mean, how much more dear to the heart about humanity does it get?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's not an accident that I'm here. I'm very lucky to have been selected for the position. But in terms of my background and experience and sort of just the things that we were taught as kids and growing up that I learned, you know, professionally, the what PAL does is, you know, hand in glove to all the lessons that I learned as a child. I had two great parents. My sister is very involved in public service as well. So this was a natural fit for me.
Now, when you were young, obviously you have a different outlook and perspective on the police force. What did your friends think? Were they in awe that your father was a cop?
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag.
Sure.
I think it's not – it was similar then to now. There's, you know, part of – some of your friends think it's cool that your father has a gun and your father investigates serious cases. And the others – I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and others, you know – thought he was a pig and thought that that was a bad thing to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, over time, you sort of sort it all out and you, I think, you understand where those observations come from and you know, you work with them. But, I mean, we understood that my father was a really good guy, was a great father, and I think he understood as a police officer that there were challenges in the police department that had to be addressed. So I think we had a pretty healthy outlook.
How often were those messages brought home and instilled into you and your sister?
I think a lot, and some of it is because of, and this conversation is happening now in our society, you know, as an African-American teenager growing up, I think my father's first order of business was keep my children safe. Hmm. And so we were taught for both sort of pure reasons to be polite to the police, but also for practical reasons. Don't escalate a situation. Yes, sir. No, sir.
And it was just basic respect.
It's both basic respect, yeah. But I think also a little bit of a feeling that you don't want to make a situation more tense.
Exacerbated.
If there's a police officer out there, and the vast majority are not this way, mm-hmm. but if there's a police officer out there that's going to look at you more harshly because you're a young black kid, don't take the bait.
No.
Because I need you to be safe. Mm-hmm. You know. So I think the combination of respect and a little just self-protection.
There's a lot of dialogue with the former police commissioner. We're going to obviously talk about the Police Athletic League and who they serve, but I want to get to an overall umbrella sense of, because the real message is twofold, I would imagine, to make it more succinct is obviously to give the kids mentors, insight, a safe place, et cetera, what I mentioned before, a nurturing educational environment, but also to connect them with police officers at whatever level. Even up to the commissioner, I think, who even turns on the water hydrant. And
yes, he does.
In the springtime, which is cool, with Mayor de Blasio and former your boss, Morgenthau.
Mr. Morgenthau, yes.
Which is great that they're hands-on. But to keep that link open, because it shouldn't be that a family or a child, inner-city child, only sees the cops when there's something bad going on.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think the way I view both the community relations in general and with the Police Athletic League in particular, is that the first time someone meets a police officer, for most of us, it was in a tense setting. It was a speeding ticket. It was a, you know,
noise
something.
Violation.
Yes, something that went wrong.
Exactly.
Right? It would be great if all of us had our first encounter with a police officer in a positive way. He played ball with me. He taught me how to use the computer. He came to a play street. And so I think what PAL tries to do, and I think what society's looking for us
desires, yes,
is to sort of create some of these relationships and conversations, yeah, where the community maybe is not meeting its end of the bargain, mm-hmm, or where the police,
sure,
are not meeting.
Absolutely.
Create a conversation where you can get to, mm-hmm, a solution.
Even if it's as simple as just they're sitting on a stoop. Hey, guys, what's up? How's school? I can now play hoop. There's a court down there. Oh, it doesn't have any, you know, nets. Let me see what I can do.
That's exactly right. So I think that this tension always existed. But I believe maybe now more than ever, some of these sort of relationships that you're talking about are really needed for us now. And we're, I think, well positioned to sort of deliver on them.
Now, two things I have to confess to conjuring up in my mind, I always thought, and it's probably the movies that we've all seen and maybe the articles that we've read, that when I think of POW, Police Athletic League, I always think of a gym, a sweaty gym, kids in there with protective gear, with their POW shirts on, boxing in a ring.
Right.
That's no more, right?
That is no more. We've evolved. And I think our core, obviously, is to create opportunities for kids to both have fun and to learn. And but we've evolved so that in the current environment, we have programs. We're really an educational and youth development organization.
Sports as well.
Are a part of it.
Sure.
And many of us who liked sports saw that as a positive way to sort of develop. But we have after-school programs. We have science programs, computer programs. We have a lot of college readiness programs.
Fantastic.
So we really focus on education. And obviously, sports is a part of education. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the boxing world, growing up, I was a boxing fan. But where PAL is now, we're putting our resources into sports activities with – no controversy,
cerebral.
no potential concussions. No, so we've evolved from just sort of a one trick pony to a real full service education organization.
When did this 100-year-old organization, which celebrated about a year or two ago,
that's right,
change direction in that?
I'm not sure it changed direction, but my sense is it evolved. As the community asked for more, we tried to deliver more. We also have good partnerships with local government. So if local government is looking to create an after-school program, we were kind of positioned to sort of expand in that regard. So I can't give you sort of a date where we decided to do this, but I think over time, and as you go back in our history and look at some of our older reports, you can see this evolution of community needs and us trying to respond to them in a broader way.
Well, that's a great segue, Fred, because I did my due diligence and I researched you because I'm interviewing a lawyer, in a sense.
Yes,
so,
that is
you know,
true.
I got to do my research. My wife is a lawyer. And every time I say to her, how did you find that? She goes, I took a course in research. So every time I find something, I'm like, I didn't take a course in research, but I found it. But anyway, it was a great article that appeared in the Times last year, Making Play Streets Mean Streets. Great quotes in there, et cetera. And I want to read just a portion about Michael Blue Williams. He's a music industry manager. I think he oversees Outkast and a few other prominent people. But when he was a kid, inner city youth kid, he was stopped by a cop for, I think, jumping a turnstile or something like that. And the cop said to him, where are you coming from? And he said, POW. And he gave him a break just based on the fact that he knew right from wrong. I'm sure there's some greater depth of dialogue in there. But the article had a lot of interesting points. But it just goes to show you that obviously you're not going to cure every kid of doing any wrongdoing because kids are kids.
That's exactly.
No matter whether they're in New York City, Idaho, or California. But the fact is that there's a great template. And what I really enjoy reading about is the fact that, de Blasio and our former mayor Bloomberg both embrace early childhood programs,
yes,
which the POW has.
And that's when you talked about our expansion, that is one of the things that has helped us expand. The city has focused on this. We have been able to develop an expertise. And actually, as early as 2 years old, through Head Start programs, we've established Head Start programs for ages 2 to 5. And these early learn and other after-school programs for younger elementary school kids. And that's a combination of POW being able to sort of step up to that challenge and commitment from people like Mayor Bloomberg, Mayor de Blasio, looking for community-based organizations to deliver this. Because, and I think I heard you speaking earlier, those after-school hours, everyone knows, are the tricky hours.
Could be deadly.
And their crime statistics show this. Any parent who's at a job and has their child at home alone, it just creates potential for problems. And if we can have an organized after-school program, which we do, we have, I think, about 6,000 kids throughout the city in various after-school programs, we can sort of eliminate that potential risk. So we can both not only eliminate a negative, but we can also provide a positive.
Absolutely.
We can provide, a place for them to do their homework, somebody, a tutor to help them with their homework and other activities.
In that article as well stated that over 100 years ago, then Commissioner Woods started the POW. and a lot of the police officers were involved, and it's kind of interesting to read because there were actually the kids that were involved back then were actually given some form of uniforms and would run and I guess how the sports program was born and created. How many cops nowadays, and also we all understand that cops are very busy people, just like we all are, and I imagine some of them feel that, you know, it's difficult and their family obligations and for many other reasons. Maybe they just want to do their job, punch in, punch out. But how many officers in a general sense are involved with PAL?
We have the officers fit into sort of two categories. There's a sort of an organized part of the police department, the community affairs unit, I think it is, that reaches out to community organizations and does that as part of their job.
Separate from PAL?
Well, often collaborating with PAL. And other organizations, so an NYPD officer in community affairs' job is to do community affairs work, which might be anything, might be PAL-like activities. Mm-hmm. But in addition, many of our programs we rely on volunteer police officers to coach kids in various sports. I believe we have four sports: flag football, softball, basketball. I think there's a fourth sport.
There is. I'll get to it.
And where the depending on the age, the police officers either coach the kids or actually are co-participants. We have mixed teams of police officers and kids in various sports. Many of those officers are volunteer, so they're doing their regular job in some other unit, and then they volunteer their time, and we provide the structure to take that really just great offer of their time and their energy and create a structure that will help bridge this. We often call them cops and kids programs, but to really create not only a healthy sports environment, but a good mentoring environment for the police officers. You asked me a number. I don't want to commit to a number.
That's fine.
But it's in the hundreds of officers that either volunteer.
In the five boroughs.
And we've been experimenting with ways with the police department to try to see if we can increase that. The officers are willing to do it, but of course they have other responsibilities as well. So the balancing of their free time and their other police responsibilities.
You think with the first prong that you mentioned with the PAL and other organizations that they volunteer with, that the new commissioner and the mayor are going to be pushing for more of this?
It's clear to me. I've had a fair amount of interaction with the police commissioner. I mean, when I say fair amount, meaning I've seen him at various functions and talked to him about specific things with others and our board members. He is, you know, the real deal, if you will. He believes this. He talks the talk and walks the walk. So we've always had a very warm and good reception when we reach out to the PD and say we would like to do this. And that comes, I think, from the top. The mayor, who I do not know and do not interact with, but it is clear that his funding priorities and his interactions with the community-based organizations like us are clearly playing into the things that we've been talking about.
Sure.
After-school education and other programs for kids, especially kids that may have some economic challenges.
And speaking of budgetary, your financing background is very big, and that's what you did a lot, as well as practicing law in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office as an ADA. The operating budget is any $25-26 million?
About $26 million, yes.
It sounds pretty impressive, but you know there are a lot of programs, and when you're serving 35,000 plus kids, I'm sure it gets used up quite quickly.
It does. It does go fast. Yeah. We get a fair amount of government funding, but we are pretty aggressive about our fundraising as well, our private fundraising and corporate fundraising, with the hope that we can create as many programs and touch as many kids as possible. So, we are aggressive about seeking money, but again, to provide a really quality program, it takes resources, and we really try to seek them and then use them on the kids.
Now, you mentioned before about the activities and or involvement from police officers, and I imagine it runs the gamut from guys who walk the beat to decorated officers. Actually, former Manhattan District Attorney Morgenthau is still on the board?
Yes, he is. One of the reasons that, you know, we talked about sort of my family and background, but one of the reasons why sort of the PAL was so front and center to me is because I worked for him for many years, 25 years, And he was always so committed to the police athletic.
Well, now I have to interrupt you because now I have to read a quote from Robert Morgenthau because, you know, it's great. He says, PAL chairman and former Manhattan district attorney, we are truly honored to have Frederick Watts accept the position of PAL executive director. Fred is one of the most respected leaders in Manhattan district attorney's office and has risen to the highest levels of management within the office. And I mean, Robert Morgenthau is pretty well respected, you know, nationally and maybe even more so. Because he's dealt with a lot of issues that, you know, drew national and or international attention. But my initial thought was that essentially the PAL is civilian run.
Yes, the PAL is sort of, I won't say it's misnamed, but it's
kind of like the Port Authority. It's like a hybrid.
It started 100 years ago with police officers being run in the police department. We are now a completely independent civilian-run youth services agency. But the special sauce, of course, is the collaboration with the NYPD. So while we are civilian-run, I think what sort of separates us from other organizations and addresses some of the things we've been talking about is that really strong collaboration and support we get from the NYPD. So,
talking about the juvenile justice program, I know you partner with NYC departments of probation, parole, and corrections. I mean, this has to be a big initiative because, you know, kids make mistakes.
Right.
As I did, you know, you just grow out of it or you just realize, hey, I made a mistake.
Right.
And sometimes there's not a choice.
I think one of the tricky things that my experience, both as a prosecutor, now with PAL, and quite frankly as a father, is all kids make these mistakes. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, your circumstance may determine how it goes.
Absolutely.
And so, and often for a poor inner city kid, that the options of alternatives mm-hmm. to the criminal justice system just aren't available.
And lack of accountability.
Right. And so it goes more negatively. What we hope to do is when a kid makes a mistake, and I don't want to sort of sugarcoat it. So he's in school and he punches somebody in the face. You know, if my kid in some suburban school does that, he probably gets punished, but
suspension,
right? But a kid in a different circumstance might get arrested and charged with assault. And if that happens, PAL is there to kind of say, let's figure out what you did, let's figure out how to hold you accountable, but to grow from it. So that 2 years from now, rather than being on your third arrest, you will
be charged as an adult.
Exactly. Now, instead, I made a mistake. I got some counseling. I did some job training. I got a mentor. And now I'm on a better path. And it's really been a very gratifying part of this position for me to see those kids. And I go to some events and I was chatting with a woman who was a young woman who's 18, 19, and she was on her way to college and she was full of, you know, ideas of what she was going to major in. And the person running the juvenile justice program leaned over to me and said, you know, she's in the juvenile justice program. She was arrested a few years ago and we got her and she's great and she's full of potential. And she just learned from the mistake. And now we're talking about a college student. So it's really a great opportunity to kind of, yes, you made a mistake, but it's not the end of your
absolute fruition to the mission.
Absolutely.
And is that labeled the alternative to incarceration program?
Well, we sort of put it all under the umbrella of juvenile justice programs. Some of them are alternatives to incarceration. Some are other sort of conditions of probation. By whatever name they are, mm-hmm. they're basically, you made a mistake at a certain age.
Let's rectify.
Rather than throw away the key, let's pull you in here, make you show up 3 days a week, get you a counselor, teach you how to do a job, give you an internship, make you graduate from high school, you know, all the things that we all should be told to do, you know, and we've really had some real success in getting people back on track.
Now, Fred, how would you be alerted to something like this? For example, does a school reach out to you?
Often it's either
police department?
The police department, and very often, again, depending on the ages, because mm-hmm. they're different systems, the Department of Probation. So
is it discretionary or is it part of a protocol?
It's part of a – I think the answer is both.
Okay.
I think it is – part of a protocol to examine, and then at the discretion, if we think this kid can succeed, we're going to turn him over to you, and you're going to report back if he has done the things or she has done the things that we've asked them to do. And so we learn about, you know, these a particular kid, typically incidents, from either family court, criminal court, or the Department of Probation.
Could you be part of the process before the court process actually happens?
Typically not. They sort of happen in tandem.
I see.
It's we have a situation, we are thinking about a solution, and we think PAL may be part of a solution. It sort of happens at once.
My mother is part of an organization in New Jersey, and I forget what the actual name of it, but I think it's similar to this. The kids caught shoplifting. It could have been me. Yeah, have you heard the
I did hear the talk. Little
Yeah. Hey, I didn't steal. I just switched the price tag, right? But it's great because if they're caught with a few joints or something, you know, without actually changing their whole life trajectory, you know, again, we're talking about mistakes here. They meet in front of a board, Juvenile Justice Conference, that's what it's called. Four or five people, one, I think there's a police officer and some other civilians that are, you know, regarded in the area, and they try to right the wrong. They come back again, you know, a third time, then, you know, whatever happens. But,
right.
You know, there are things in place in the suburbs, which is good. I don't know how different court systems and or municipalities operate, but it's great to see the templates out there.
Absolutely. And we I'm familiar with some of those initiatives, and I think they actually have tried some of those things in New York, but the volume is so great, it's harder to.
Absolutely.
And that's, again, why. So let's take our harsher system. But let's put, be it Police Athletic League or other organizations, let's make them make the best of it. So maybe it starts out with we only have these three options, you know, probation, jail. But within those, let's nurture a kid
sure.
who just made a mistake.
Absolutely.
Because if he made that mistake in the suburbs, he might be sitting in front of a board and on his way to college. Let's give the kid in the city
the same
and
how often do we hear about these incidents in the last couple of years, more importantly? Where they're posting on social media what they've done or are part of, and their whole life is just bam,
right.
over.
Right.
Oh, it's crazy. So I want some numbers. I'm not going to hold you to the exact
okay.
number, but so last year, what do you think possibly with PAL, the amount of individuals you helped in terms of the alternative to incarceration program or however you want to label it?
We're somewhere around 500 to 600 kids.
That's a lot.
During the course. Yes.
That's great.
Yeah. We've kind of expanded to, I know we went, recently we expanded to a more robust program in Brooklyn. We sort of think of it in terms of boroughs. So if we have a relationship with the Bronx mm-hmm. probation, then we, so we're up around, a safe number is around 500.
What is the initiative that's on a national level? I think Obama, I think Christie's behind this, and I know my municipality, Monmouth County, New Jersey, is behind us in terms of, I forget the actual term, but in terms of reducing the number of people convicted to incarceration, jail. They're trying to, whatever the offense is. Does this make sense? Does this sound
yes,
familiar?
You
know what it's called?
I think essentially, I think that the sort of the national conversation now is that there are people who are in jail for offenses that, where they should be held accountable, but jail's not the place to hold
Absolutely.
Them accountable.
Or even if before they get there, if
right.
it's their first offense, whatever the offense is.
That's right. Our focus, of course, in a if we do our job perfectly, they never get there because we've had them in our daycare program, in our after-school programs,
sure.
and they don't make these mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But where we kind of fit in that conversation is we – and I know this from my prior life as a prosecutor. If a person has done an assault, let's say, and he's 16 years old, and even the hard-boiled prosecutor wants to give him a break, but if there's no – program, system, safety net, if you will, to turn him over,
sure.
then the judge and the prosecutor feel, I can't turn him over there because it's going to float.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just going to have to go with the tried and true 30 days in jail. What we can provide is I'm going to look at you, prosecutor or probation or judge, and say, I do have an alternative. Give us a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone will feel more comfortable with that. So I think where we sort of fit in that sort of Obama conversation is to say, give the criminal justice system real alternatives. Some people from my prior life, just have to be in jail. You know, if they're of a certain age or they've committed a certain offense where there really aren't other options. But
show
for
no
kids,
remorse and don't
yeah.
even want to be a part of the police athletically because he sees you as the enemy.
Yeah, but for kids who make the knuckleheaded mistakes that I've seen my own kids mm-hmm. make and I would have to fess up I've made now and again, you know, give them an alternative to bounce back. And I think that's what we – you know, sort of provide.
Could you foresee your programs hopefully getting more money earmarked for PAL because of the initiative in a national and or local basis?
I am hoping so. But the interesting thing I've seen is that our funding, we get a pretty good amount of government money. The government has not been particularly generous in funding these programs, which is somewhat surprising. If you look at the array of what we provide, you'd think that the government would look at these programs as almost an offshoot of the government system.
Absolutely. It's almost like an insurance company paying for maintenance, health maintenance,
exactly,
to avoid a bigger, greater problem.
But oddly, our funding is not great. I mean, we do get some support, but it's not as great as some of the other programs. And so I'm hopeful that, you know, clearer heads will realize that this investment is, you know, part of the government service that they're providing. But we have been fortunate that private citizens and foundations have recognized, I think we all recognize that, you know, these stumbles as a 16-year-old where you take a kid's cell phone and break it because you're mad at him, and then you get charged with criminal mischief and grand larceny, that should not be the end of that kid's life. That should be you made a big mistake, come here, and let's talk about channeling your behavior so that you don't make this mistake again. That's what should happen to a teenager.
Those charges could actually stick?
Oh, absolutely.
For something like that?
Oh,
really?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's not so much that people are mean-spirited.
Mm, sure.
It's what tools are you given? So when the teacher is called or the school safety officer is called and they point and they say, Mark yelled at me, took my cell phone and slammed it on the ground, and it happened that way because they were just mad at each other. Mm. Well, they come, the school safety officer, the school say, what tools do we have available? And the only tools they really have, at least at first blush, they can't just send him home, are whatever the school disciplines are, but and the penal law. And once they use the meager tools they have, it starts a process that can be harsh. And so if we introduce other elements to that process, like youth services organizations, like PAL, maybe we can keep us on the right track, which is to address that problem. It's a problem.
Absolutely.
But it's a problem with a solution different from standing in front of a judge and getting a criminal conviction for the rest of your life.
Don't want to hear that gavel. Yeah. Sidebar here, but closely related. I can't help but think, Fred, about sponsorship, like AA. Everyone has a sponsor. You know, you feel like you need a drink. You're going down a bad road that day. Is there anything officially in place, or maybe just some of the civilians and or police officers say, listen, hey, I like you, Pete, Mary Jane, whatever the case may be. Here's my number. If you ever feel like you're going to do something wrong or you need help before sirens come on.
Perhaps not as specific as you describe, but all of our Cops and Kids programs promote that kind of at least relationship that, you know, this is my cell phone number, you can call me, or you know I work in the 4-4 precinct,
sure,
you have a problem, you reach out to me. I think a lot of our Cops and Kids programs in the sports areas really try to establish some form of connection between kid and cop so that they can feel they can reach out. You know, I went to a our flag football Cops and Kids Championship, which is teenagers primarily playing flag football with police officers. And it was really sort of interesting to see that they, you know, these kids sort of, if you use traditional stereotypes, you'd look at them and say, these aren't the kids that are hanging with the cops. You know, they just look like regular old with baggy pants.
Oh,
and
absolutely,
hanging, you know.
Yeah.
But
they have a good time.
But they clearly had relationships. Mm. And they were, you know, they were they practiced together and they played this game together and they high-fived each other when they had good plays. And these relationships, I think, at least are the starting point to develop some of those mentorships.
Well, I think it benefits them both because the kids actually see that they're not just cops, they're human beings.
That's right.
You know, good people. Some of them are good at flag football. Some of them are not.
Not
so
much.
Some are serious. Some are overweight. Some are in shape. And then the cops get to see that some of these kids, well, these are good kids.
That's right.
You know, I see that, you know, they wear hoodies or this or that. And you know, what's the word I'm looking for? State troopers are always known to do this.
Profile.
We profile these kids or inner city youth, and, you know, we're wrong.
That's right.
You know, these are good kids and they need opportunity, and that's why I'm glad I spent the day with them. Question for you.
Sure.
Do you have – I totally lost my train of thought. That's what happens when you get up at 4:30 on Thursday. This is my early morning. Well, I'm going to go in a different direction because it's very important and very, very topical. As a father, I don't need you to divulge exactly what you say, but as a father, former prosecutor with the ADA's office for how many years? Almost 30?
Almost 31.
You look damn good. Would you start when you're 12? Oh, my God. In shape, too, no
I'll
less.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah,
I'm trying.
You should
I'm
run
trying.
With that compliment.
I'm trying.
What do you say to your kids and or other pal kids about your online presence and identity and persona?
Well, I'll tell you, I've had a lot of conversations at home about this, and
sure.
We try to, in PAL, do the same thing. And it's tough because there's a clash of cultures. The culture I grew up in, none of this existed. Mm. You didn't have to worry that if I, the way I ordinarily communicate to my best friend, if I said, hey, you know, and said something sort of inappropriate, I would be saying it to him face to face or maybe over a clunky landline. Today, my kids would say the exact same thing, but their first inclination is to text or Instagram or post it someplace. That's just the way they've been taught to communicate. And I guess sort of the one story I'll tell is one of my sons was about to go to college, and he was a good athlete, so he was getting some recruiting interest. And I looked on his Facebook page. It wasn't anything terrible, but he had some crass joke from Family Guy.
Sure.
Yeah, kind of a silly thing. But. And I said to him, you know, if I were a college coach looking for a good kid to play, you know, for my team, I don't know that I'd want to bring in the kid that told these kinds of jokes casually. Mm. And both
for
of my—
For the world to see.
For the entire world to see. And never goes away.
Cemented.
And both of my sons were there at the time. They looked at each other and they asked if they could be excused from the table. And they ran upstairs, clearly to change their...
Omit their posting?
Yeah. Mm. And what it told me was they had the right idea. Mm. But their behavior, because of the standards, the behavior didn't conform to that idea. They knew this was a... When shown to them that this could be a problem, they immediately got it. Mm. But their first instinct, which is the way we communicate now, is to post.
Just to communicate.
Right.
So not know any repercussions.
And
or...
we try to, you know, in the teachings we have with kids and just general, and our staff as well, to just try to understand that I get it that in the current world we are inclined to take pictures of ourselves and post them.
And to write it as fast as your fingers can go and not even think about what the impact could be.
Right.
And the effects.
Yeah, that notion of, you know, the don't press send.
No. it's almost like that email, you know, you want to send your coworker.
Right.
When you're mad, you know, you got to wait a day. But that doesn't exist in cyber world.
That's right.
Wait 60 seconds, that's a long time.
That's right. So we try, and I try at home. But it's a challenge because all the sort of rules of the road now in our culture are different. They're contrary.
Oh, absolutely.
We're
constantly changing as we're speaking. No, Fred Watts is the executive director of the New York City Division of Police Athletic League. Have anyone come full circle in terms of gone up through the ranks, been a child, teenager, et cetera, and actually either become an employee of PAL or become a police officer?
Absolutely.
Yes.
We have certainly, and
that should be in your press material.
It certainly should.
One
of our challenges that you talked about research, we really are sort of need to embark on essentially a search of PAL kids, because you bump into you get the anecdotes, you meet police officers that say, "Oh yeah, I was in the PAL program and you know such and such," but we need to be more sophisticated about it. And I think, as you pointed out, you can do research these days that will make it easier to do that. Within our midst, you know, I went to a meeting the other day. I had a meeting with the people who run the centers in a particular borough. It was Staten Island, actually. So I'm meeting people who are the center directors. It's a significant job, and they were all quite impressive. And I said, and I'm, you know, the relatively new executive director. I said, you know, I've seen you guys around, but let's create a relationship. Tell me about yourselves. How did you come here? And this woman just casually mentions that she was in our college readiness program as a teenager, decided that based on that to go to college. She went to college. She loved PAL. She came back. She started as an activity specialist, and now she's running a center. And she says it as casual and
nonchalant.
And, yeah, and I'm like looking at this as this great accomplishment. And so the good news is
running up the flagpole.
That's exactly right. But we do have those stories. We had a kid who was in our juvenile justice program, and he's now one of the really strong, you know, supervisory people in our teen program. He made that mistake. He got turned around. He finished high school. He went and got a bachelor's degree at a local college. And now he's working at PAL, and he's really helping. So it's a triumph for them, and it's a triumph for us. And then we can actually use their skills for the next generation that comes through.
What differences do you see? I believe that you volunteer in New Jersey as well, between teens, and this is a macro question, and maybe the problems they get into and or how they're resolved versus the New York City PAL.
I think the teens are by and large the same. In other words, it's really the circumstance. So, you know, if you're drinking beer as a 17-year-old at a park in suburban New Jersey and the cops roll up on you, you may be sent home. They may call your parents. But you
basically outrun them.
Or you outrun them. But if you do that and you're sitting on a stoop in Brooklyn and you try to outrun them, you might get cited for not only the open container, but resisting arrest. Mm-hmm. And the only thing we have to do, now you're in family court. So I think kids by and large are kids, but it's
shaped
the
by
circumstances.
Absolutely.
When they make the mistake they're going to make, it often dictates how it's going to go. And so I just feel like PAL is supposed to sort of add some gentleness and reason to a system in New York that's not inappropriate, but it can be harsh for a segment that's young and needs a chance to turn it around.
Fred, how about some final thoughts on the future of PAL? Obviously, it's money-based, some federally funded, some corporations hopefully are kicking in a great deal of money. If you had some extra couple millions lying around, what would you like to institute?
I think what I've sort of seen, the programs that are near and dear to me that I think are can just be enhanced. One is our sort of focusing on our teens and college readiness. We have a really great program. Last year we were in one borough in Queens. This year we've expanded it to two. So now we're in the Bronx in Queens. We have a relationship with Fordham in the Bronx. So kids are actually being mentored by Fordham University students with an eye towards going to college.
Sure.
That should be in all five boroughs three times the size. So that's one thing that I'm really sort of particularly interested in.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. And one thing I have to bait our listeners with that we didn't get to, entitlement. I imagine a lot of kids, all of us, you know, nationally, but inner city youth have an entitlement issue. And we can't talk about it now, but that's more food for thought because I imagine you come across kids who feel like they got the short end of the stick, whether their parents are divorced, in a drug-infested area, et cetera. And I'm sure that's a major issue that PAL employees have to deal with.
You know where to find me. You can invite me back if you wish.
Oh, absolutely. And your website is PAL dot...
NYC dot... I'm sorry, PALNYC.org.
Fred, real pleasure. And lastly, I like to say that my mantra to all the people I speak to is my difference makes me stronger, because we all have disabilities in life, the way we think, the way we act, whether it's real or perceived. And I believe this is applicable to these kids as well, whether they're in an inner city or a suburban environment, because it's all circumstances, as you said, and it's up to them and the people around them to kind of set forth the things that went wrong. And it's very doable.
It is doable.
Fred, all the best to you.
Thank you very much.
This has been Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Looking forward to catching you next Thursday. Always catch me at Mark at MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Mark at MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Special thanks to Jason Taubenfeld, Program Director, Jesse at the Controls, and of course, our founder, president, and talk show host. What's his name? Gary Null. Man, I need some sleep and some food. All right, guys, have a great day. Talk to you next Thursday. Enjoy.
Good stuff.
Thank you very much.
Great.